As we move from Parshas Truma to Tetzaveh, we move in subject matter from Klei HaMishkan, Mishkan VeKelav, to Bigdei Kehuna, to the clothes of the Kohen and the Kohen Gadol. That is certainly the main topic of Parshas Tetzaveh. But before we get there, there are yet two psukim, which are something of a juncture between Truma and Tetzaveh. They're the final two psukim of Perek Kaf Zayin. Ve'ata tetzaveh es b'nei Yisrael. You, and of course we know who you is, even though Moshe's name is not mentioned in the Parsha. It's the only Parsha post the birth of Moshe, where till the end of Torah, where his name isn't mentioned. There's a lot of discussion about that. Bikru elecha shemen zayisach, let them take for you pure oil. Kasis lamor, beaten for the light, laha'aloth ner tamid. And I would like to focus for the first few moments of the shiur this evening on this phrase, on this expression, laha'aloth ner tamid. Of course, it resonates with us, the concept of a ner tamid. But I actually hesitate to translate the phrase because we will see there are significantly different approaches as to what it means, even in terms of its translation. We begin, of course, with Rashi. So Rashi comments on the word tamid. Kol laila v'laila koroi tamid. Something that happens every night is called tamid. Tamid, always. In what way is it always? Because every night? Kamosha ata omer, Rashi establishes for us that the word tamid can mean something that is daily. Olas tamid. You have the daily ola, the korban tamid. It's called the korban tamid. Ve'eina ela miyom liyom. But it's really from day to day. It's not something that's brought the whole time. And therefore, Rashi's explaining to us that the word tamid here does not mean without interruption. It doesn't mean constant, that it's always burning. After all, the menorah is lit once a day. At night, in fact, it's the final avoda of the day. And Rashi really is telling us two things. Firstly, the pasuk says laha'alos ner tamid, the mitzvah to light the ner. How many ners are lit? Well, as we know, there's a mitzvah to light all seven. And thus, the first point is that although it says ner in the singular, but often we find the singular is a generic plural, that it says ner, but it means neros. Like we say ner Chanukah and ner Shabbos. It can be more than one. Laha'alos ner tamid is actually referring to lighting all seven lights, which are called ner. And the second point, as we've mentioned already, is that the word tamid here does not mean constant, but rather it means regularly. If I'm correct, this is the difference between the words continually and continuously. If something is continuous, that means it's without interruption. Something that's continual means it's regular, but we say always. A person can say, I always eat breakfast in a certain place. It doesn't mean without interruption, or at least one hopes not. It means every morning for a certain amount of time, but it's always in that sense. Okay, so these are Rashi's comments, lahalos netomin, to light the menorah on a daily basis. No day can be missing. That's why it's called tomit. The Ramban quotes Rashi, but takes issue with him, based on a medrash, a Toras Kohanim, in fact. For if you look in the Toras Kohanim, and this phrase appears elsewhere in the Torah, laha'alos ner tamid, actually the menorah is presented in the Torah three times, in Chumash Shemos, in this week's Parsha Tetzaveh, in Chumash Vayikra, in the end of Parshas Emor, and in Chumash Bamidbar, of course, in the beginning of Baha'alosecha. The phrase laha'alos ner tamid also features in Parshas Emor, and the Toras Kohanim there explains that the reference is to a specific ner, what we call the Ner Ma'aravi, the middle light, depending on how the menorah was configured, but one of the lights, as we know, carried on burning beyond the time for the others. Most of the other lights lit from night till morning, and the Ner Ma'aravi kept on going without interruption. It never wasn't burning, because as soon as, for only a momentary relight, because for the next evening, they would actually relight the others from the middle one, which had been burning the whole time. Then it was put out, and then immediately relit. So which means it is essentially, Tomit, it is lit the whole time. Says Ramban, the words Laha'alos Ner Tomit are a reference to the Ner Tomit, to the Ner Ma'aravi, which burnt continuously. And thus we find that the Ramban, based on the Medrash, on this Teras Kohanim, takes issue with Rashi, actually, on the very two points that we mentioned. Namely, firstly, the word Tomid does not mean regularly. It really does mean continuously. It refers to the one there that did burn without interruption. That's the first point. And secondly, we see that the Ramban takes the word ner, the singular of the word ner, to actually only refer to one of the neros. This is not neros tamid. It is ner tamid, and only one of them was the ner tamid. That's the ner ma'aravi. Now, the reason why I mentioned we hesitate to translate these words l'ha'alos ner tamid is because if we take a good look at these words, we will see that essentially the machlokas between Rashi and Ramban, let us call it that, is whether or not the word tomid, if we have a look at these three words, lahalos, which is a verb, ner, which is an object, and tomid, which is our hot word that we want to know what it means, which word does the word tomid qualify? Does it qualify the word lahalos, that is to say, the kindling is tomid in the sense that it's regular, or does it qualify the word ner, that the ner is tomid in that it burns constantly? That is the question. So one could almost say that the question is, do we say it's lahalos tomid es haner, or lahalos es haner tomid? That's how it would come out. According to Rashi, the word tomid qualifies the word lahalos. This mitzvah of lahalos is tomid. It's regular every night. One is the Kohen is ma'ale, whereas for the Ramban, he is ma'ale what is called the ner tomid. Tomid qualifies the ner. Okay. I believe, I haven't seen anyone who mentions this, perhaps because it's simple, or maybe for other reasons, but I think there is support for Rashi from within the Pasuk. What is there to say? I mean, you only have these three words. From where would we deduce support? Me'ayin yavo ezri. Underneath the word ner is a tam, cantillation, called a tipcha. Now, the tipcha is probably the most underrated tam of all of them, because it's rather straightforward to say, but we need to appreciate that the tipcha functions, l'havdil for us, it's convenient in English, but it functions as a comma. There is a slight pause at a tipcha. Anyone who reads Torah the way it should be read will pause at a tipcha, momentarily. And we should know, by the way, the pause of the tipcha can be decisive. It can change the meaning of the pasuk entirely. I'll give you probably a very pronounced example. If we take a look further on in Parshas Kisisa, Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Tes Vav, we will see an example of a pasuk that if we ignore the tipcha, we will reverse the halacha and completely overturn the meaning of the pasuk. So, Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Tes Vav. Sheishes yomei miyaseh melacha. For 6 days, work shall be done, melacha shall be done. Uvayom ha'shvii Shabbat Shabbaton Kodesh Lashem. The seventh day is Shabbos. And now, final words. Kol ha'oseh melacha biyom ha'shabbos mos yumas. Anyone who does melacha on the day of Shabbos shall be killed. Now, consider. Where is the tipcha? The tipcha in those final words is under the word Shabbos. That's where it needs to be, because one needs to pause there. For now, the meaning is, anyone who does malacha on the day of Shabbos, slight pause, mos yumas, he's to be killed. He broke Shabbos. Imagine if one did not pause at the tipcha. Everything would be reversed. For then the meaning would be, kol ose malacha, anyone who does malacha, ever, b'yom ha-Shabbos, mos yumas, shall be put to death on the day of Shabbos. Which, of course, is not true. What's very interesting is, if you look at the Tamim and Kala'osa Malacha, they're what's called the Darga Tavir, and they're slightly more involved than the straightforward Tipcha, and therefore there's a tendency to pause after them, to give them a certain gravitas. But if one does pause after those words, then that becomes its phrase in itself, and B'yom HaShabbos gets put together with Mos Yumas, that's actually gravely incorrect. And therefore we see that the tipcha is there, it has to be taken notice of. Sometimes it even expresses itself in terms of what's called a tam mafsik. As we know, at the end of a sentence, or at the end of a significant phrase in a sentence, the nikud can change, typically to a komatz. Kesef becomes kosef, kena'an becomes kena'an, everything becomes moved up to a komatz at the pause. That is what's behind the classic question as to whether we say Mashiv HaRuach or Morid HaGeshem or Morid HaGoshem. You say Geshem, I say Goshem. The question really is whether it's considered to be the significant end, the end of a significant phrase. If it is, it will be changed because of the Tam Mapsik from Geshem to Goshem. Now, the rule is, we may be interested to know, that it is always the strongest pause, because there's a hierarchy of pauses. It's the strongest pause that changes the nikud. And the strongest pause in a pasuk is in esnachta, that we know when one pauses for a while. Second to the esnachta, the next strongest pause, is what's called the zokif, the two dots on top of a word. And third in line is the tipcha. So the tipcha is the weakest of those three, which means it will almost never change the nikud of a word, because it will always be together with either an esnachta or a zokif. So it will rarely express itself in that way. The only time it will is if it's such a short pasuk that there isn't room in the pasuk for any other pause. There's no esnachta and there's no zokif. All there is a tipcha. And if you have a case like that, the tipcha will change the nikud of a word. Finally, we will feel the tipcha. You find, for example, the pasuk says in Bamidbar Perek Tes Pasuk Beis, V'yasu b'nei Yisrael es ha-posach b'moado. B'nei Yisrael shall bring the posach. Now the word is Pesach. It's called posach because of a tam mafsik. We finally found the pasuk that was so short there wasn't room in it for anything stronger than the tipcha. And the word Pesach has a tipcha, and that's how Pesach became posach. Why are we talking about the tipcha in this way? Because I believe it's decisive, or at least influential, in this question of Rashi and Ramban. For the tipcha, in these final words, back to the beginning of our parsha, the tipcha is under the word ner. That means that there's a slight pause after the word ner, as if to say, laha'alos ner, pause, tamid. That means that the word laha'alos ner go together, kindling the light. The kindling of the light will be tamid, as Rashi said, regularly. Once a day. According to the Ramban, there shouldn't have been a tipcha under the ner, because ner tamid goes together. One doesn't pause between the word ner and tamid. So that seems to be support for Rashi. So one really needs to look at everything in this phrase in order to get a sense of what supports whom. Now, let us not forget, we haven't finished. The Ramban did marshal support for his position from the Taras Kohanim. It's not the Ramban. Taras Kohanim is the Medrash. It's Chazal. And they said that the reference is to Ner Tamid, to the middle light that burns continuously. So what will Rashi say to that? Is he arguing with the Medrash? So Maral says in the Gur Aryeh, no, of course Rashi isn't arguing with the Medrash. But what's crucial for us to understand is that the pshat and the drash, which we speak of so often, what distinguishes one from the other is that the Pshat always takes the straightforward approach. The Medrash is Doresh. It seeks out a more rigorous or thorough approach. There are many questions that the Pshat would not consider them to be issues, but the scrutiny of Drash, the sensitivity of Drash, would consider them to be issues. And it's really a higher level of scrutiny. And that will come out very often in the issue of redundancy. Is a word extra? Is a word redundant? Well, how do you decide whether a word is redundant? You have to ask, well, would I have understood the meaning without it? If I would, it's redundant. But that very question may depend on whether you're looking at these words through the lens of Pshat or Drash. Because if you're looking through Pshat, so Pshat is the straightforward meaning, and on a straightforward meaning, one doesn't hold the text to such a high level, a high standard of redundancy, as if to say, anything that if I looked at it long enough, I wouldn't need that other word, renders the other word redundant. On a straightforward level, something like Laha Alos Ner Tamid, it's perfect. The mitzvah is regular, it's all in place. It is true that the Taras Kohanim said the word Tamid refers to the Ner Tamid, to the Ner Ma'aravi. Why did the Medrash say that? Because according to the Medrash's higher standard of looking at the Pasuk, the word Tamid is redundant. Because if the Pasuk said, Laha Alos Ner, there's a mitzvah to light the menorah, and didn't specify, presumably it's regularly. It's hardly likely to be irregularly. It's not going to be once in history, and anything that's regular is daily, as far as the Mishkan is concerned. And therefore, if you look at it in that rigorous way, you will say, you could argue, had it just said Laha Alos Ner, I would have known that it's regular. I would have known that it's Tamid. And therefore, if the Pasuk adds on the word Tamid, it's got to teach me something else. That word now says Darshani, and the Medrash says Hineni, and darshans it. But says Maharal, you can never really ask why Rashi didn't explain like the Medrash if the Medrash used the methodology of Medrash, and Rashi's using the methodology of Pshat, because the fact remains that al derech ha-pshat, the word Talmud is not redundant, and its most primary and most intuitive meaning is regularly. We've seen a reference to one candle over the others. And thus, Rashi and the Medrash live side by side, each one bringing out the flavor of the methodology, one of Pshat and one of Drash. Okay, so we have subjected these words, Laha Alos Ner Tamid, ourselves to quite some scrutiny. There's only two possibilities. It either refers to all the lights, means regularly, or it refers to the middle light, and it means constantly. It's either one or the other. Until the Malbim enters the discussion. And we will see that there's actually a third possibility. How can there be a third possibility if there's only two options? So the Malbim asks a fascinating question. The earlier source we have about the idea of Ner Tamid, this one light that burnt longer than all of the others, constantly. Where was it quoted from? Ramban quotes Taras Kohanim, in Parshas Emor, Chazal have spoken. Says Malbim, I have a simple shaila. Chazal also have a commentary on Chumash Shemos. It's called the Mechilta. The Taras Kohanim is the commentary on Vayikra. On Mechilta, the Medrash Halacha is called Shemos. If you look in the Mechilta, on our Pasuk, on the words Laha Alos Ner Tamid, you will find nothing. So now the question is, if Medrash determines that the words Laha Alos Ner Tamid refer to the Ner Tamid, to this middle light, why did Chazal wait an entire Chumash, a lot can happen between now and then, to make this comment? Why didn't they make it in Parshas Tetzaveh? Why delay? That's a good shaila. The only thing better than a Taras Kohanim to explain the Pasuk in Shemos is the Mechilta on the very same words. And doesn't say anything. So the Malbim presents a certain yesod, a certain principle, which is really fascinating. Sometimes, says Malbim, you find that words can have more than one meaning. That is to say, they can have a broad meaning, but they can have a very specific meaning. And it can really be the same word. If you talk, for example, about the concept of a shah, a shah can be a while, or it can literally mean 60 minutes, an hour, depending on context. How do we know? How can we know if when the Torah uses a word, it means it for its more general or broader, looser context, or if it means it very, very specifically? Says Malbim, sometimes the way it works is, if the Torah uses a word or an expression once, so then, without any other way of determining it, we interpret it in the broad sense, in the general sense. But if the Torah will repeat the word, it repeats it in order to emphasize that the reference is to the specific meaning, much more, much tighter meaning. And he gives an interesting example. The word boker. Boker means morning. Morning is the beginning of the day. How long does the morning last? Well, of course, that really depends who you ask. But we understand that it can mean the very beginning of the day, or it can mean the beginning portion of the day. I mean, the morning could be a long time, until it's the afternoon, it's the morning. Now, we should know that the Gemara tells us, in terms of the Seder of the Avodah, the Ketores, which is discussed in this week's Parsha, the Ketores came before the Korban Tomid. How do we know this? Where does that derive from? Says the Gemara in Maseches Yuma, Daf Lamed Daled, because the Korban Tomid, the Torah says to bring it baboker, esakev esachat taseh, baboker, in the morning. Ketores, we'll be told at the end of this week's Parsha, says, baktir, biktir alav aron ketores samim, baboker, baboker, in the morning. Says the Gemara, if the word boker was repeated, it means it's earlier, because it's the stricter understanding of what the morning is, the beginning of the day, not just the first section of the day. And therefore the repetition of the word is a reiteration of the concept, which means that it's much more specific and held to a higher standard of definition. It means the beginning of the morning. And therefore, says Malbim, we have an example of this phenomenon with this phrase, l'ha'alos ner tamid. Because we have two words, and they both could mean two things. The word ner, what does it mean? Well, generally it could mean all the lights, it could be a generic plural, it could be. Or it could refer to a specific ner. So it has a general meaning and specific. Tamid. If we're more liberal with the translation of tamid, it doesn't mean without interruption. It means regularly, once a day is also tamid. Could be. But there's also tamid, which is the more rigorous definition, which is without interruption. So now the question is, well, which one is it? Is it the looser? Is the Torah referring to the broader definition or to the more specific definition? The answer, says the Malbim, is yes. Both. The first time round in Chumash Shemos, it's related to, as always, the first time round. Ner means neros, tamid means regularly, and therefore it's actually much closer to the pshat, even as far as the Medrash is concerned. That's why the Mechilta on Chumash Shemos doesn't comment on these words, because there's nothing to say. It's left lefi the pshat, to light the menorah regularly. The Toras Kohanim picks up on it because the Toras Kohanim is meeting it for the second time in Torah. Once it's been repeated, the phrase Lehalos Ner Tamid, all of a sudden, Tamid means something else. Ner means something else. Ner means the Ner Ma'aravi, and Tamid means continuously without interruption. And that is why we only find the Chazal commented in Parshas Emor, in Chumash Vayikra. So these are really fascinating discussions, all of which are generated by this rather innocent-looking phrase at the end of the first pasuk, Lahalos ner tamid, and before you look around, entire worlds are growing up. Rashi has his approach, Rabban has his approach, you have the Toras Kohanim, Malbim harmonizes everything, Kedarka shelter. Okay, so that's just before we get to Big Day Kahuna, which certainly formed the centerpiece of Parshas Tetzaveh. And from there, let us take a look at how the Big Day Kahuna, the making of the Big Day Kahuna, are introduced. And that's in Perek Kavches, Pasuk Beis. The well-known Pasuk, V'asisa Big Day Kodesh la'aron achicha, l'chavod u'lisifaros. So holy garments are made for Aaron, l'chavod u'lisifaros, for honor and for glory. Okay, that, and thus ushering in the enterprise called Bigdei Kahuna. Let's see Pasuk Gimel. Ve'ata tedaber al kol chachmei lev. This is again Hashem talking to Moshe. You shall speak to all those wise of heart. Hashem melei siv ruach chachma, that I filled with the spirit of wisdom. Ve'asu es bigdei Aaron, and they shall make Aaron's garments. Lekadsho lechanu, to sanctify him, to make him a Kohen for me. Okay? I acquired a while back a sefer called Meleches Machsheves. It's out of print. It's from one of the early Acharonim called Rabbi Moshe Chayfetz, at considerable expense, actually, but worth every penny, no question about. And Rabbi Moshe Chayfetz, he is a master of Parshanut. And he gives us insights through questions that he asks and through answers that he gives, really opens up some of these psukim that we may have passed over them without giving them a second thought. You see, consider, says Moshe. Look at Pasuk Gimel. It doesn't seem to be saying anything, essentially, that wasn't said in Pasuk Beis. It seems to be a restatement of Pasuk Beis. Pasuk Beis says, they shall, in our words, they shall make clothes for Aaron. Next Pasuk says, speak to the Chachmei Lev, and they shall make clothes for Aaron. It's the same. It's the same clothes. Look at China. What did Pasuk Gimel say that hasn't been said in Pasuk Beis? Moreover, says Meleches Machsheves, look closer at Pasuk Gimel, and you will see that it isn't homogeneous. In what sense? Va'ata tedaber kol chachmei lev. Speak to all chachmei lev. Chachmei lev is a plural. We're referring to a number of people. Next, Hashem mileisiv ruach chachma, whom I filled him mileisiv, not mileisim. Mileisiv moves to a singular for some reason. We don't know. But then the pasuk concludes, ve'asu, and they shall make as big day Aaron. So we've gone from Loshon Rabim, Chachmei Lev, to Loshon Yochid, Milei Siv, back to Loshon Rabim, ve'asu, v'adavar omer darsheni. I mean, that's quite a fluctuation. It's just the touch of the words. Finally, asks Meleches Machsheves, Moshe is told to speak to these Chachmei Lev and tell them to make the Big Day Kahuna. It's interesting to compare and contrast how Moshe is told to speak to two groups of people at the beginning of the Parsha, but the verb changes. The first thing he's told to say is the beginning of the Parsha. Ve'ata titzaveh es b'nei Yisrael. You shall command b'nei Yisrael to do the following. V'ikvelecha shemen zayizach. So Moshe's communication to bring the shemen to him, which is the mitzvah, is phrased as tzivui, command, titzaveh. In this pasuk, it says, v'ata tedaber al kol chachmei lev. Speak to them. But you're telling them to do something. That's a command. The pasuk should have said, v'ata, once again, titzaveh, es kol chachmei lev. It's the same concept. So these are very interesting shilas. All of a sudden, the pasuk is not so straightforward. Okay. Says Rabbi Moshe Chayfetz, and it's a fascinating discussion in and of itself, but even before we get back to read another look at the psukim. See, a key factor, as we know, with regards to the production and the manufacture of the Mishkan and of the garments and all of these things, is the issue of kavana lishma. It's got to be done with purity of intent. We are told this from the very outset. V'asu li mikdash. Li, Rashi comments, li lishmi. V'yikru li truma, li lishmi. It's got to be lishma. Anything which is of such a holy and sensitive nature, the intent in terms of what goes into it is decisive. We know for ourselves in our own experience, a sofer stam, they've got to be written lishma, they've got to be written l'shem mitzvah, and if they're not, the ksav can be beautiful and the tefillin apostle. Kavana is decisive. And so too here, everything that's made, it's important for us to remember, because sometimes we get sidetracked or focus more on the details of how it looks, but the focus always needs to be, and the intent always needs to be L'shem Hashem, Mishkan Hashem. Okay. So the Meleches Machsheves just mentions for our consideration. From this point of view, we'll appreciate it's easier to make the Mishkan Lishma than it is to make the Big Day Kahuna Lishma. It's easier to make the building of the Mishkan and the Kalim of the Mishkan L'shem Mitzvah than it is to make the priestly garments. Why? For a very simple reason. And it's a human reason. The Mishkan is the Mishkan. It's there. And people come, they perform avoda with it. And it's really, it belongs to Hashem. The Big Day Kahuna are made for a person. They're worn by a person. These garments that they're working at and developing and reaching the final product, someone else will be wearing them. L'chavad u'l'sifaris. It's no longer abstract. It's now subjective. And by that we mean the extent to which the people make, the Chachmei Lev, make the garments of the Kohen Gadol, Lishma, will be completely dependent on the extent to which they consider the Kohen Gadol to be a worthy and pure person to wear those garments. Because if they feel that he's wearing them perhaps for his own personal glory, so they see their enterprise as heading towards that. That's why the Lishma factor, when there's a person who will be wearing these garments at the end of the day, it's much harder. The first thing they need to be appraised of is the fact that Aaron is indeed a worthy carrier of these begotten. His intention as he wears them will be L'shem Shamayim, and therefore your intention as you make them should be L'shem Shamayim. And now, says Meleches Machsheves, let us come back to these two psukim, Pasuk Beis and Pasuk Gimel. The first is the mitzvah. Basisa big de kodesh, la'aron achicha. You've got to make these holy garments for Aaron. L'chavad u'l'sifares. And now we're in a very volatile domain. Because does Aaron deserve to wear these clothes? And are they really making them for the purest of motives? That is what is addressed in Pasuk Gimel, where it says, V'atot tedaber el kol chachmei lev. Speak to chachmei lev. This is not the mitzvah to make the garments. That's in Pasuk Beis. V'asisa b'kdei kodesh is the mitzvah to make them. But the necessary background for the purity of intent, speak to the chachmei lev. What will you say to them? Say the following. Hashem milesiv ruach chachma. That I filled him with ruach chachma. So our question initially was, we've shifted from the plural to the singular. Chachmei lev, Hashem milesiv. Says Meleches Machsheves, the singular of the plural isn't referring to the chachmei lev. Pardon me, the singular of milesiv isn't referring to Chachmei Lev. It's referring to the individual mentioned in the above pasuk, La'aron Achicha. Speak to the Chachmei Lev and tell them Aaron deserves to wear these begotten. He will wear them for the purest of reasons. Hashem milesiv ruach chachma. Hashem says, tell them in my name I filled him with ruach chachma. And what will be the result of that? V'asu es bigdei Aaron lekatcha lechanuli. The result will be they will fully embrace him as someone who deserves to wear the begotten, and their intention will be entirely lekatcha lechanuli. So it's a wonderful specimen of parshanut from one of the great early acharonim. All of these diyukim, as we find so often, the more we are medaktik in the pasuk, the more we look into the details, the more the full picture emerges for us. And now, let us take a look at the Bigdei Kahuna themselves. They are described across a number of psukim. Generally, as we quoted the pasuk Beis, Vasisa Bigdei Kodesh L'Aaron Achicha, L'Chavad U'L'Sifares, for honor and for glory. What is the purpose of making clothes for Avoda L'Chavad U'L'Sifares? Well, the Sefer HaChinuch discusses this, as do others. And the Sefer Chinuch explains, based on a theme that he develops in a number of mitzvahs, that it is very often the case that a person's inner feelings are affected by what they do and what they see. If you wish to promote a value, one can discuss it to a great degree, but sometimes the message comes through in other ways, hopefully. And what that means in our context is, if you tell people that the avodah is extremely important, and hopefully they'll listen. But everyone is affected, and everyone's impressed by garments that are l'chavodu l'sefaris. The message being projected by the garments is, this is a very important enterprise. Everyone is affected by what they see. They see the Kohen Gadol, they see the Kohanim to a lesser degree involved. Look at how they're dressed, look at their garments. They're wearing chashuv clothes. That means they're involved in something chashuv, and that's a visual way of getting the message across that the avodah is indeed something of the most serious nature and most significant nature. So this is the classic general explanation of the Sefer HaChinuch, why it's important that Big Tikkun should be l'chavod l'sefaris. And so it is, l'havdil, ben kodesh l'kodesh, we try and make a shul look nice, all of these things that people should realize it's important, l'romein beis elokeinu. There is another aspect of Big Day Kuhuna, which the Gemara talks about twice, actually, in Zvachim Daf Peches and in Erechin Daf Tet Zayin. And it draws our attention to the fact that the Big Day Kuhuna are always mentioned in conjunction with the Mizbeach, twice, both in Parshas Tetzave. Pardon me, there's two ways of understanding what the association is, but the mentioning is in this week's Parsha Tetzaveh, because as we move on from Big Day Kuhuna, it goes on to talk about how to bring Karbonos on the Mizbeach. And that gives us a classic Smichus Parshios, a juxtaposition of two ideas. What do they have in common? Which is an interesting question, because obviously they have a great deal in common. The Kohen wears the Big Day Kuhuna to do the Avodah. But the Gemara says more than that. The Gemara says, we learn from the smichus of the Big Day Kuhuna to the Mizbeach, that the Big Day Kuhuna have the same effect as the Mizbeach has. Just like the Mizbeach through Korbonos can affect Kapara, so too the Big Day Kuhuna can affect Kapara. The wearing of the Big Day Kuhuna is a Kapara for Bnei Yisrael. And in fact, the Gemara goes on to detail which Aveira receives atonement for which of the Begadim. It goes through them one by one. And the Tzitz is for Azus Metzach, and it brings sources, one for the other. And let us take a look at some of the examples, but we'll preface with a fundamental statement about this from the Sefer Akedas Yitzhak. The Akedas Yitzhak, Rabbi Yitzhak Aramah, one of the great late Rishonim, who wrote a systematic treatise based on Seder HaParshas. And he says something which I think will resonate with our discussion last week. We say that when the Kohen Gadol wears Big Day Kuhuna, so it brings kapara for the Jewish people. It atones for... Says Akedas Yitzhak, well, how does that work? Is it simply the wearing brings kapara and we don't need to do anything? He's not inclined to understand that way. Rather, as is true for the Mishkan generally, the Big Day Kuhuna have a message for the Jewish people. There's something about each of the Begadim that relates to the Aveira in question. The kapara comes from taking the message to heart. As surely as we saw last week, V'osuli Migdash, V'shachanti V'socham, V'chein Ta'asu, look at the Migdash and act accordingly in your day-to-day affairs. That will bring V'shachanti V'socham. So too, look at the Big Day Kuhuna, consider their message. That's what will help a person achieve kapara, because hopefully it will help them deal with the Aveira itself. And he brings a number of examples, and let's have a look at four of them. The Choshen, well, the Choshen is called, right, the breastplate, it's called Choshen Mishpat. And indeed, the Gemara says it comes as a kapara for Ivus Hadin, for perversion of justice. And once again, Akedas Yitzhak wonders aloud, does that mean that if there was a perversion of justice, but if the Kohen wears the Choshe Mishpat, it's okay? It's not okay. The point is, a Dayan needs to take a good look at the Choshen Mishpat. Maybe he'll reconsider the way he deals with his cases. For Akedas Yitzchak, as he often very systematic, lays out for us four reasons why justice would not be performed correctly. Number one, it could be, as the Torah tells us, not to favor people. Sometimes one has a... He favors someone, he's sympathetic towards them, he has a relationship with them, or feels sorry for them even, whatever, or maybe they're a chosh of a person. The Torah says, Lefsakiru panim b'mishpat. That's hard. A person, the dayan needs to be completely transparent. Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin, in his Dinei Torah, he had the two Bali Din in a different room so that he wouldn't see them as he heard. So it could be anyone talking. He wouldn't have some type of recognition that's a choshev person. He just heard two voices with Adim to ensure that they were actually people who were doing the talking. But it was completely leveled for him. Okay? That needs to be addressed. Secondly, again, these are facts of life. Sometimes the judge is intimidated by one of the people. And again, the Pasuk says, Lo soguru mipnei ish, the dayan, he can't be afraid of anyone, because he might be afraid of some people. Ki ha-mishpat le'lokim hu, because justice belongs to Hashem. You're his emissary. Sometimes you have to take a stand to be mechayev of someone who's a powerful person. It's not easy. Sometimes it's not done. Thirdly, says Akedas Yitzchak, sometimes the dayan doesn't really give the din due consideration because the matter isn't really significant in his eyes. Perhaps it's a small amount of money. It may make a difference to the people involved. He doesn't consider it to be such a huge amount and therefore not such a significant case. There is a tendency to address lesser significance to a lesser amount. In fact, we find for all the praise that he gets, as Yisro famously made a suggestion to Moshe that they should set up that system, that pyramid system of Sarei Alofim, Sarei Meos, Sarei Asorot. So he says, Es hadavar hakaton yishbetu heim, v'adavar gadol yuvio elechor. Vice versa, hadavar gadol yuvio elechor, hadavar katon yishbetu heim. Big cases should come to you. And the small cases they can deal with. What's a big case and what's a small case? A lot of money is a big case. That should go to you. Small cases they can deal with. Even as Moshe implements, as we saw, to a degree, the advice of Yisro, but this he changed. The system was, Es hadavar hakasheh yaviu na Moshe, a difficult case, a hard one to answer, they brought to Moshe, and everything else they could. In other words, what Moshe had said, what comes to me, is not if it's a lot of money. If the answer is easy, that doesn't need to come to me. If the answer is hard, it needs to come to me, even if it's not a lot of money. It's a completely different vision. But again, this is a tendency that needs to be overcome. They're arguing over 50 shekels, whatever it is. If one is right and one is wrong, the Aveira is the same. And finally, says Akedas Yitzchak, sometimes Pasha, the Dayan hasn't invested enough time in developing expertise. He's underqualified, but he already wants to judge. The answer, the response, and the negation of all of these is to be found is embodied in the Choshen Mishpat. How so? Says Akedas Yitzchak. The first thing we find about the Choshen is that it had 12 stones of all of the Shvatim. Now we know that some of the Shvatim were more dominant and more prominent than the others. Levi are the Kohanim, Yehuda, Malchus, etc. and so forth. In what order do they appear on the Choshen Mishpat? Says the Pasuk, Ketoldosam, the way they were born. It doesn't mean anything. No one is first because they're bigger or better. No one is given preferential treatment. If you're born first, so that's why you're on there first. If Plony was born first, if the other Shaper was born, he'd be there first. And that's a message to the Dayan. No one gets more preferential treatment than the other. They're just in order of birth, that's all. That's how you have to look at it. Secondly, the factor of perhaps he's afraid, but the Pasuk says, Lo sagur mipnei ish, don't be afraid. Why? Ki ha-mishpat lelukim hu, you represent Hashem. to that end, inside the folds of the Choshen Mishpat were what is called the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim, Rashi explains, were certain shemus of Hashem. Shem Hashem is within the folds of the Choshen Mishpat because it means that Hashem is present at the Din Torah and you represent Him. And therefore, remember that as you proceed to judge a case. If you are the Choshen Mishpat inside, and you should be carrying with you the Shem Hashem in the Urim V'Tumim. What about the amounts? So this is a fascinating point. It says, okay, that's Yitzchak. If you know the nature of the stones of the Choshen Mishpat, you'll understand that they're not all worth the same amount. Some of them are rather common. Some of them are extremely rare. We have the famous Yoshveh, that they went to exorbitant amounts of money. That's the famous case of Doma ben Nesina. He's the only one that had it, and they paid through the roof. But there are other stones that cost a few shekels. And the Choshen is incomplete without all of them. If the one with a small amount is missing, the Choshen is as possible as if the most expensive one. And what does that tell us? That the Torah doesn't distinguish between whether there's a great deal of money involved or a small amount of money. They're all part of Choshen Mishpat. And so is all cases part of Choshen Mishpat, whether it involves a small amount of money or a great deal of money. And finally, what we know about the Choshen Mishpat is they're called the Urim V'Tumim, had the effect of Shemeirim B'Dvareihim. They illuminated the questions that were asked of the Urim V'Tumim. The answer came out in an illuminated fashion, clear and bright. Metamim D'Vareihim, decisive. And that's the message for the Dayan. Do not proceed to carry the Choshen Mishpat and what it represents unless your knowledge is clear and bright and you've mastered the areas of halacha that you're judging over. So we have a fascinating communication, really, to any dayan. The Choshen Mishpat is talking to him. This is what's mechaper for Ivus Hadin. Pay attention and take the lessons and act accordingly. The Eifot, moving on. The Eifot says the Gemara is the kapara for avodah zarah. How so? If we look through Tanakh, says Akedas Yitzhak, we will find that ephod was typically a garment that was used for avodah zarah. The other ephods that are mentioned in the most of them in Tanakh are ephods for avodah zarah. It's an apron. Now, what's fascinating about the ephod? If you've ever looked at it, maybe it didn't occur to us. It's actually worn. If you understand that an ephod is an apron, it's worn backwards. It's actually the back of the kohen that's covered. And the front is where it ties. That is the reverse of what an apron how an apron should be worn. What does this mean? Rambam explained, as do others, other Rishonim say for Ikrim, more in fact, that the beginnings of the problem, of the mistake of Avodah Zarah, is that they perceived certain entities, the sun, the moon, the stars, they perceived them as acting, in a sense, independently, as having the capacity to act independently. That is to say, they saw them acting, and they felt that they could be appealed to act, to respond, to request, to act for the person. And what that means, l'moshel, is the sun acts. The sun dries things. If one has sun-dried fruit, that means the sun dried it. And that's not Avodah Zarah, because it did. Avodah Zarah is to say that if one asks the sun, it will dry better, or more, or only his fruit, more than someone else's fruit, etc. and so forth. That is to say, to take a dependent act, and to relate to it as an independent act, that is the beginning of the disaster called Avodah Zarah. And therefore, says the Akedas Yitzhak, what's the antidote to this? What's the depth of perspective that preempts the problem of Avodah Zarah? A person needs to realize very simply that all of these forces, you see them acting, but they're not acting of their own volition. They're entirely dependent on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And thus the Eifod is reversed, because the body of the Eifod covers the back of the Kohen. And what's interesting is, it's actually suspended from the Choshen Mishpat. As we know, as the Pasuk describes at length, that means that the Eved is held in place by its connection to the Choshen Mishpat, in which lies the Urim V'Tumim, the Shem Hashem. The message that's being transmitted is that all of the forces represented by Avodah Zarah, that would otherwise be the focus of the Eifod, they are secondary. They're all dependent on the Shem Hashem. And that's the antidote, essentially, to the thesis of Avodah Zarah. The kesonis, that's the tunic that was worn. The Gemara says the kesonis is an antidote for shfichos damim, and it actually references the kesonis pasim that was vayishchatus the irizim. How is the kesonis thematically an antidote for shfichos damim, for bloodshed? So Akedas Yitzchak says a fascinating thing. If you look at the kesonis, it wasn't just a shirt that covers the upper part of the body. It goes from head to toe, and in fact it's quite narrow. That's why the Kohanim, as they would walk, they would take rather narrow steps. They couldn't take wide steps because their legs are actually encompassed by the bottom of the kesonis. What does that mean? Bloodshed often and significantly happens through an instantaneous reaction, an overreaction, in the heat of the moment. As is so often the case, if a person would ever do something like that, if thinking back as if they only thought about it more and not reacted so abruptly and instinctively, that it never would have come to it. But before you know, it's all over. The message of the kesonis is, don't jump. The kesonis doesn't allow you to move that quickly. It restricts your movement as if to say your movements should be measured. They should be considered. If the person is that far away from you, don't take one step and plunge the knife in. It may take you six steps, and between step number four and five, you may reconsider. And this, therefore, it's a measure, to temper one's reactions, that they should be more moderate. That will preempt a great deal of what would otherwise be a violent eruption. And finally, for our purposes, it's the fourth out of eight, but the last one that we will discuss is the Me'il. The Me'il, which was it was one of the most striking of the Big Day Kohen Gadol. It's full of treles, it's entirely, and then at the bottom it has pamon v'rimon, that's the pomegranates, and has the bells. Wherever the Kohen goes, you'd hear bells. Ringing whenever the Kohen Gadol walked. Vinish makola b'vo'el HaKodesh, it should be heard. The Gemara says that the Me'il is an atonement for Lashon Hara. The sound of the bells at the hem of the Me'il is a kapara for Lashon Hara. Says HaKodesh Yitzhak, how is the sound of the bells at the bottom of the Me'il kapara for Lashon Hara? As we know, every bell was inside what's called a rimon. There is a machlokus when it says betocha rimonim, it means surrounded by rimon, by these pomegranates made of material, or actually inside. The bell is literally inside the rimon. That's Rashi and Ramban. We're not going into those details. But in principle, the pasuk refers to it as being inside the rimon. What is so significant about pomegranates that they're at the bottom of the Me'il? Says Akedas Yitzchak, a pomegranate represents everything that's right about the Jewish people. There's a famous, it's a Gemara in a couple of places, in Brachos and Dafnun Ches, Kefelach Harimon Rakoseich, Pasuk in Shir Hashirim. Rakoseich, says the Gemara, is from the word rake. Afilu Rekonim Shebecha, even empty people among the Jewish people, Melei Mitzvos Kerimon. They're full of mitzvahs like a pomegranate's full of seeds. How can that be? They look empty, and they're full of mitzvahs like a rimon. There's always redeeming features for everyone. Depends on how you look at it. Says HaKadosh Yitzchak, an unbelievable thing. The ringing of the bell is the sound that a person makes. And says the Torah, you know what the type of sounds to make? The bell should be inside a pomegranate. When you talk about somebody else, it should be a pomegranate dicker talking. there's plenty of good things for you to talk about. Why do you have to talk about the bad? Every bell that sounds should be inside a pomegranate. Find the good in them and discuss that. It's a fascinating thing. And I think there's perhaps room to add a certain further point. We really got to the bottom of the matter in the sense that we focused on the hem of the me'il, the bells and the pomegranates. But what about the rest of the me'il? And again, it's a kapara for Lashon Hara. The me'il is entirely tcheles. What's tcheles got to do with Lashon Hara? Tcheles, as we know, through the mitzvah tcheles and tzitzis, it's reminiscent of so many things. Tcheles looks like the sea, which looks like the sky, which looks like the kisei hakavod. What that means is that the tcheles is a sound that represents, is a sight that represents, reminiscent of and represents the kisei hakavod, or as the Netziv says in Parsha Shelach, it represents a person's highest aspirations. A person who wears clothes that are the color, so to speak, of the kisei hakavod means it's a person who's looking to aspire to the kisei hakavod. He's looking to live an elevated life. Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin says a foundational point. A person who is looking to grow spiritually has to be able to see the good in others. Why? For everyone is impacted and influenced by their surroundings. If you live in a positive environment, it inspires you to do better. If you live in a negative environment, it can cause you to do worse. And very often, the question as to whether you live in a positive environment or a negative environment is dependent entirely on how you see things. If you only see the negative in everyone around you, you live in a negative environment. A negative environment is a setting for negative conduct. If you see the positive in people around you, so you live in a positive environment, and that encourages you to do better. It's a fascinating point. And ultimately, it's a reflection of the person themselves. Because if a person seeks out the bad in people, it's because a person has stopped demanding of themselves, and therefore they prefer to be surrounded by people who aren't doing so well, because then that allows them also not to do so well. The Rebbe Yitzchak of Berdichev says, and it's a Hasidish vort, so do not expect pshat here at all, but it's very true, and it's really the epitaph of Rebbe Yitzchak himself. The pasuk says in Parshas Balak, Lo hi bit oven b'Yaakov, v'lo ra'a amal b'Yisrael. Hashem elokav imo truas menopo. He doesn't see any iniquity in Yaakov. He doesn't see any wrongdoing in Israel. Hashem is with him. All of it refers, Hashem doesn't see wrongdoing. Hashem is with the Jewish people. He doesn't see any wrongdoing in them. But the Berdichev said, in his way, Lo hi bit oven b'Yaakov. If you see a person, he doesn't see wrongdoing in others. If a Jew doesn't see wrongdoing in others, v'lo ra'a amal b'Yisrael, then you know that Hashem is with him. Hashem elokav imo, because he's attuned to a godly way of looking at things, where he seeks out the good because he wants to do better. And I believe all of this is embodied in the fact that the bells and the pomegranates, which are the things that we say, which is a reflection of the way that we look at things, they are the hem of the me'il. The hem ensures that the garment does not unravel. What ensures that a person's me'il, that a person's tcheles aspirations do not unravel, is that they perceive a positive surrounding around them, which encourages them only to do better. And thus, I believe, the material of the me'il is also part of Lashon Hara. And we see that Lashon Hara is the undoing, not only of a person's relationships with other people, but essentially of a person's spiritual advancement themselves. Because if everybody else is so rotten, so then what does anyone expect from me? And that's the end of his higher aspirations. The kisei hakavod and the aspiration for all of those things is kept alive by a person seeing the positive in all of them, in all of those around them. These are some of the themes and some of the aspects which gives us an entirely new dimension to what we mean when we say the big day kahuna or a kapara. It's not necessarily a natural without demanding anything from us. On the contrary, it demands quite a bit to be alert, to be observant, and to respond and act accordingly. We'll leave it over there.